When the tape ended, you were talking about one of the first disputes that you had with a faculty.
Well, this was the head of a big department on campus, and there was an egregious error made by that department, which was going to be very embarrassing if they didn't correct it. When I called the head of the department, he literally screamed at me over the telephone, and he said he'd never bothered by the ombudsman before. He didn't want to be bothered by me. This was not something he was going to deal with. It was just a terrible conversation. And I burst into tears when I finished talking to him. And the secretary saw that I was crying and asked me why I was crying. And I said, oh no, nothing. I wrote him a letter in which I said, when I dried my tears, I realized that I had not explained this sufficiently well to you, but this is an error that is going to be embarrassing if it's not corrected. When I showed a draft of the letter to my husband, he said, tear that letter up. No tears, that's what they expect a woman to have as a reaction. You just tell this person in a very short note that since he doesn't want to be bothered, and since you report directly to the president, you will simply contact the president next time there's a problem in his office, and then the president can deal with it. And I got a tremendous apology very quickly that week, and we were kind of buddies ever afterward.
So your husband's counsel was good.
He was very helpful. He was very helpful. And my learning curve went up rather rapidly at that point. I don't know if you are going to ask me what I think was my biggest achievement as the ombudsman. But
of course.
I'd be glad to tell you. When I was fairly new still on the job, this was an academic dispute, and it was one where a student had been severely punished for the absence of a single day. And there was no indication that there was something that happened in that single day. He got a zero for the class for a single day's absence in the whole quarter. This was not a terrific student, but otherwise, he would have passed the class. Student filed a grievance under the Academic Freedom Report and won the grievance in his department because the department said there's just nothing on the syllabus that indicates that one day's absence was not a test. It was not any special day. It was just a day. There was no mechanism in that original Academic Freedom Report other than persuasion to get justice done for the student. I went to the department head, agreed with the student. In fact, the student won on an appeal, too. The faculty member refused to change the grade. I talked to the dean, and the dean said, nothing I can do. The dean said, he's a horse's ass, but there's nothing I can do. I determined then that the Academic Freedom Report really needed to be changed. It was a long struggle, and part of the antagonism came from students on the Academic Council because they wanted students to be in charge of students' grades, and I knew that was never going to fly. But what we finally achieved, it was about a two-year struggle through the Student Affairs Committee and then through Academic Council, was that some named individual, the dean, if no one else will act, must see that justice is done if a student wins a grievance. And, you know, on appeal also, everybody's got a right to appeal, both sides. That hasn't had to be invoked too many times, but it has been invoked. And it means that you're not just spinning your wheels, because if persuasion were all that it took, you could have persuaded the faculty member in the first place. But there are faculty members who will no more part with a zero than they would part with a grain of rice in their rice bowl. And I consider that change in the Academic Freedom Report to be my monument. It doesn't say Stieber on it, but I know it's there.
When was this accomplished?
This, I would have to look it up to give you an exact date, but this was early in my ombudsman years.
It was President Wharton was still, or was he president yet?
I believe so.
What would you say your relationship was with President Wharton in terms of working relationship?
Well, my relationship with President Wharton was one certainly of deep respect on my part. I liked the way he handled my annual reports, which I put a lot of time into, and I thought that by clipping them apart and sending them to the relevant places and asking for comments and replies, that was a way of getting something done. In truth, we did not have long conversations about very many things. A few times a year, I might call his office about something. He was very helpful and very supportive, and I think he understood what this kind of job was supposed to entail very much. I didn't have any problem with subsequent presidents, but subsequent presidents did not use the report in quite. They always sent me a letter thanking me for the report, but you know, whether they did anything with it or not, I don't know. In the latter years, by the time President DiBiagio was in the office, a good deal of the contact was with the provost, with David Scott, rather than with the president's office. But I did need to talk to the president on a couple of occasions, and he was very helpful. Mm-hmm. I should stress that the ombudsman does not have any tenure as ombudsman. You have tenure as a faculty member, but not as the ombudsman. So I really served at the pleasure of the president, and any president who wanted to replace the ombudsman, all they had to do was say, I replace you. Mm-hmm. So I was rather pleased that due to a change of president several times that I was retained without lifting a finger to bring that about. There was no way that I could cause that to happen. And
have the university presidents since President Hanna, have they respected that office?
As far as I know, the answer is yes.
In terms of not replacing one just at will, when they disagreed.
As far as I know, they have. Now, of course, I started with President Wharton. Mm-hmm. I think we had an interim of about a year with President Hardin. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that President Hardin was aware of the office.
Okay.
I'm not too sure. I think I saw him once in a receiving line, and I think I said, hello, boss. And he sort of looked at me as if to say, who is she? Uh-huh. But certainly I think that was true of President Mackey and President DiBiagio. And I suspect that the office problems have changed. I would guess that registration is much less of a hassle now that it's handled in a totally different kind of way. I don't know whether financial aids is the same kind of hassle that it's always been for so many students, because we have a very large number of students who are getting some degree of aid, and the rules are complicated. But I would say the answer is yes. There are presidents at some universities who have abolished ombudsman offices. However, more are established every year. The number that are abolished are very small. But some important ones have been abolished. Ohio State is one that comes to mind. But continuance here, I think, is reasonably assured, at least that's my impression.
Mm-hmm. Was your office directed primarily towards students, or
only students?
Okay, not faculty.
It's written that way in the Academic Freedom Report.
Okay.
Now that's an interesting question, because there are ombudsman offices on other campuses where the ombudsman deals with students, faculty, support staff, unionized staff, everybody. That was never true here. It's written strictly for students. We have a faculty grievance officer who is, in a sense, a counterpart with somewhat different responsibilities, mm-hmm. but that's a quite separate office. And our clerical workers are unionized employees. They have their own avenues mm-hmm. that they're supposed
to go through. Contract right. and grievance procedures.
On occasion, someone would call me or come into the office. And this happened with a number of faculty members particularly, but sometimes other folks as well. And I would explain that I'd be glad to listen if they want me to listen, but I can't lift a finger to do more than listen. But they just wanted to know whether I thought they had a case, where I thought they should go, something. I became fairly familiar with different avenues of access on the campus. I don't want to exaggerate how much I knew, because it was always a very small amount, but probably I was more knowledgeable than when I started. And there are a few people with whom I did have long conversations, either on the telephone or in person, who just wanted me to talk to them.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the situation where you had where the person treated you rudely, and as word got out, as the faculty learned about what your job was and who you were and what why you did it, did that change? In other words, did you go directly? Were there instances when you were able to, without having to threaten that the president would have to take care of this, where you were able to work with the department heads and deans
always.
And that sort of thing after they learned about your...
There were exceptions, but almost always, and I think I got smarter. I think I used a smaller amount of ammunition as I went along. I probably became more confident, whatever. And I have hay fever. I don't have a cold, but I'm always...
We can stop it.
With my...
We can hit pause.
Kleenex. Quite good. Mm-hmm. And I think I became more skilled in how to get it. And I do think that most people want to be fair. They do not want the perception out there that they're unfair. They can have high standards, and high standards are not going to be a basis on which a student's going to be able to win any kind of argument. Because a professor can be as persnickety as they want to be on what constitutes four-point work. You don't have to give 4 points at all. We did have a faculty member who failed a whole class, and the department, and then left the university. He was sending a message to his department, not mm-hmm. to the students, really. The students were just
didn't pay the price.
The troops. The department wanted to do something, and we conferred with each other, and I suggested that they ask deans and provosts to approve this, and the registrar had to get involved. They simply gave the students a pass for that term. It was not a pass-fail, it was not one of these PN, mm-hmm. pass-no-pass classes, but they just changed everybody to a pass because they were certain that this entire large class did not deserve to fail, mm-hmm. and that this was someone who was very angry with his department. I would have to tell you that a few years later, from some other university where he ended up, he called me, and he wanted some advice on how to handle a cheating case. So, but cooperation was not an endless struggle. Mm-hmm. It was, by and large, very good.
Mm-hmm. Over the
you couldn't operate otherwise. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Over the course of your career, did you see the nature of complaints change, or were there some that were the same?
The academic ones pretty much stayed the same, and the percentage of them pretty much stayed the same. Graduate students were more likely to have different complaints because graduate students were being used more and more in the classroom, and in some cases being given very heavy responsibility. And in some fields, as you would be aware, the opportunities for what's out there after you get your PhD in hand were not as attractive as they had been. And there was a, I would say over a decade or so, the change in the objectives of the student and the likelihood of the student having a rewarding career beyond this university and this degree got to be more difficult in some fields. And I think that led to some increase in graduate student grievances of various kinds. I'm not being given credit for something that I helped write. I did all the work on it. I was told that I was going to teach one section. I'm given four sections. I'm only half time, I don't have time to do my own work. I'm not getting guidance that I think I need from my committee. My committee chair is now off in Pakistan, etc. So I would say the graduate things, you could see some change there, because I think things got tougher for a lot of graduate students.
Under President Mackey, with the cuts in the programs, did the students feel that, or did you see an increase in incompletes at that time, or as a result of the disruptions and
economic downturn?
I don't think
it had much effect on the traffic that was in my office. It had a tremendous effect in Academic Council, because I remember banners being carried into Academic Council by James Madison students, and there was some turmoil over the fact that I think they had just ordered a couple of pianos for Cole's house, and one of the banners said, "Ditch the pianos, save James Madison," that sort of thing. But I did not discern any difference in terms of the traffic in my office. I was just aware of it because I, as ombudsman, had an ex officio seat in Academic Council, and so I just saw the banners, you know, come in. I didn't have a vote, and I was usually pretty quiet.
The Academic Freedom Report, which the board adopted in, was it 1967?
Yeah.
Has that been revised over time?
There have been some minor revisions. Stan Soffin could probably answer the question better than I can, because I think they were working this past year. Stan is the ombudsman now, and I think they were working this year on some other changes. There have been some small revisions. I didn't have the impression that there were major ones, except that there was a lot of time spent working up a companion graduate document, and then there's a third document for medical students. And that was sort of constantly being revised, and I don't know what the status of that is right now. The big change that I think has taken place, and I don't know that it's incorporated in the report, but after the turmoil in East Lansing, after this basketball fracas, I guess in 1999, they now have some provision where the university is able to punish a student for actions off campus. Now, the Academic Freedom Report is the opposite and bars that. Whether they change the language or they're just doing it, I don't know. But that would be a major kind of change.
Were you involved in the judiciary? Is it related at all to the student, you know, grievance that they have through the judiciary?
The student judiciaries through the student affairs offices really had to do with behavioral problems and residence hall problems and vandalism and that sort of thing. The ones that I was more familiar with were the academic grievances, which they did not handle at all. And on the grievances that did get a hearing, and there aren't ever that many of them, but there have been a few over the years, I was not someone who was participating in the procedure or anything. I was advising on how you go about setting this up. Only once did I ever participate in a grievance hearing, and again, this is one that sticks in my mind because this was a very bright student who had all 4 points in a rather rigorous class. But they had quizzes every week, and he put his name on the wrong part of the score sheet, so he got a 0 for the class.
For the whole class?
For the whole class, even though all of his grades had been 4 points.
Uh-huh.
I did participate in that grievance. I attended. I just wanted to see what happened, and the colleagues of the faculty member mopped the floor up with the faculty member and said they never heard of anything so outrageous. And I had tried to talk to this person for weeks, saying, you know, I've read the syllabus, this sounds like such an interesting class, but it's not about where you write your name. That was stupid and careless. But he never handed the things back. Mm-hmm. So the student didn't know he kept putting it in the wrong place. But I said, but that's not what the class is about. But justice was done, and the student got his 4 points. that's the only time I ever attended an actual grievance.
Mm-hmm. How about the board of trustees? Were they ever involved in terms of, you know, your contacts with them, or
I seem to remember that there was one trustee who shall be nameless, and is no longer on the board. There was one trustee who seemed to occasionally write to the president's office and say, what does that office do? And I don't know whoever answered the question. Nobody asked me to answer it. I would say the involvement of the trustees was close to zero. I think some of them knew about the office. I don't think very many of them did. Once in a while, even a legislator, you know, students who are aggrieved about something, and if their parents are aggrieved about something, they'll go wherever they think they can go. And once in a while, someone would call from a legislator's office and say, is this student being treated so miserably at Michigan State, et cetera. And I would always say, why don't you send the student in? Please send the student in. And sometimes the student would come in, and sometimes you'd never hear anything further about it. But I would say whatever it says about this community, the campus community, the greater Lansing community, I did not feel that there was pressure coming from other places. I don't think that happened. I, again, know of some colleges and universities where that is not the case. I think the legislature gives a lot of scrutiny to the university because we're down the road, so to speak. And when the turmoil was going on, you know, with the broken windows, and we had this camp of students living and
by Wells Hall, was it?
I'm not sure exactly where it was, but the university was really getting pounded by the legislature in those days. But I do not speak to, you know, what the president's office gets. That I have no idea. But I would say the ombudsman's office was not interfered with by any member of the Board of Trustees that I could ever remember, or anybody else in any political position.
Were you teaching at all during that time?
That's a good question. I was. When I started, I was teaching very large classes. That obviously had to be adjusted because I was drowning in blue books and exams and lectures and et cetera. By the next year, the large classes became somewhat smaller. I had been doing two very large classes. That became one class. And then a few years after that, that became a seminar. And a few years after that, it became independent study. And the last two, maybe 3 years that I was the ombudsman, I was not doing any teaching at all. I still went to department meetings, and I still have a mailbox over in political science, but I just couldn't, in fairness, handle it anymore. There was just, the ombudsman's office was much too busy. And by then, I had served a term as president of the college and university ombudsman. I was on the board of directors of something called SPIRE, which is the Society of Professionals in Dispute Resolution. That was a 3-year term, which involves some out-of-town excursions. I was just too busy, mm-hmm. and I just didn't think it was fair to the students. I once had one of my own students come in. This was still fairly early in my tenure as ombudsman, complaining about his grade, and I was not about to change my mind about how terrible his work was. And he screamed at me, and he said, "I don't have an ombudsman to go to." I said, "Yes, you do." Mm-hmm. And I sent everything to the president's office, and I said, "You handle this. I don't want to know what you did with it, and I don't know what they did with it. They could have done anything they wanted." But I think they gave it back to political science, and political science gave it to somebody else. But that only happened once. The teaching I loved, and it was with difficulty that I reduced it, but I just simply had to. As the years began to go on there, we were just so busy, and it really always remained a one-person office with a half-time graduate student and an assistant, and I really couldn't manage in the probably old-fashioned way that I taught with blue books and you know that sort of thing. It was just too much. Mm-hmm. I love teaching though. I miss it. Mm-hmm. And
did you remain a political junkie?
I think I am still. Mm-hmm. I think I am. Probably I concentrate on international politics. It's less depressing, mm-hmm. but I attend every year. Political science has a lot of, they have a symposium going and a lot of rather good speakers over the years, and I'm a very faithful attender of that. I just enjoy knowing what's going on in politics, but I'm not involved in any firing line kind of way. I am now on a community relations coalition. I have joined that in the last year, which was established after the 1999 fracas in East Lansing. And this consists of university representatives and business people from East Lansing and East Lansing city officials and the police department and lots of students. And I'm just a member of the community. I'm not representing the university. There are some university folks on it. Mm-hmm. But I suppose you might say it's slightly political, but only slightly.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, your husband was involved in scholarly study in arbitration and experience and consulting in that area. And then you professionally developed that area of expertise.
Well,
what prepared you for that?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I should tell you that when I was appointed ombudsman, my younger daughter was a student here. She was not living at home. She saw my picture in the paper and in state news. And she called up, and this is how she congratulated me. She said, "Why on earth did they appoint you?" And I said, "Why shouldn't they?" And she said, "You're not even a good listener." Over the years, I think I've become a somewhat better listener, and she gives me much higher marks now than she did in those days. I'm not sure. Jack and I do attend a number of meetings. He's been to some of mine. I've been to lots of his, including one just last month in Oslo. I am going to go through some training the end of this month to become a mediator. Whether I will actually ever handle a case, I don't know. But this Community Relations Coalition in East Lansing wants to offer mediation to some of the neighborhood disputes, which are largely between the so-called permanent residents and the increasing number of students who live here. And I decided that since the training's available, I'm going to go through the two, it's a fairly intensive 2-week training period, an internship. I hope I survive it, but I am going to do it.
When you came to East Lansing, did you anticipate that you'd be here for most of the rest of your career?
When we came to Michigan, I had never been in the state of Michigan. We came with a condolence of